Hi, welcome to the Top 100 Project with Ryan and Bev Ellis. If you're a new listener, we invite you to check out our introductory podcast, our prequel episode, if you will, where we talk about our project analyzing the American Film Institute and their 1998 and 2007 lists of the greatest American films ever made. Warning, there are spoilers ahead. This podcast is meant to be listened to after you've seen the film.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
So Bev, this one is fresh in our minds because we watched D.W. Griffith's 98-year-old epic, The Birth of a Nation, just 4 days shy of its original release date on February 8th, 1915. We watched it on February 4th. A little number crunching first. It finished 44th on AFI's 1998 Top 100 list, but didn't even make the 2007 list at all. It was a monster hit back in 1915, and it's one of those movies that, you know, buffs should see whether they want to or not. And since we're going through the two AFI lists in chronological order, we had to start with Griffith's two most famous pictures, The Birth of a Nation and Intolerance. Now, Birth is the oldest film by 10 years on the 1998 AFI Top 100, and its age shows. Let's face it, this isn't the best attention grabber to start our new podcast. It's silent, it's black and white, and the print we saw on YouTube was pretty terrible, to say nothing of the subject matter, which we'll get into soon. This seemed like the ultimate in vegetable-eating movie experiences, nothing like the fun we're going to get from future AFIers like the upcoming Chaplin films. So anyway, we just saw Birth. We had time to cogitate on it. Did you like it?
Well, it's funny that you bring up, call it a vegetable-eating movie, because, you know, before we watched it, we kept talking about how we had to eat our vegetables first before we got to the fun stuff, before we got to the Chaplin films. And I really was not looking forward to watching Birth of a Nation. I remember watching parts of it in film school back when I was 19, and it's just, you know, really dreaded it. But I was really pleasantly surprised how easy it was to watch. Like, it was actually entertaining, it was engaging, and the first half of the movie I was really enjoying on many levels, and I was also really impressed by what I saw when you consider how limited they would have been technologically and how little they had to draw from. So, I mean, I liked it, but I hate, in the end, you hate it because it's a despicable movie at the end of the day. It's a fun movie, an engaging movie, and then it turns into a really hateful, terrible movie.
Yeah, and I guess I agree with on that. To say, do you like it? Yes, but with a very big but. Because the first half is brilliant. Not only the technical innovations that were previously unheard of. And we're going to talk about that stuff later. And the story, though, is interesting, too. It is more engaging than you might think. The second half is not only racist, though. It's embarrassingly racist.
It's so racist that there were riots about this movie. That's in right. 1915, like, this is the middle of really serious Jim Crow days, way before the Civil Rights Act. There were riots. So if people in 1915 considered this movie deplorably racist, well, then that gives you an impression just how bad it was.
Ironically, one of the later films that made the second list, Do the Right Thing, the concern was there would be riots from that film, that the blacks would riot when they saw this film. We'll overturn the world because of this movie. And of course, that didn't happen at all. People, for the most part, talked about that they didn't do anything about it. Birth of a Nation, though, in reverse, they did.
Which is actually the exact kind of thing, kind of fears that are played out in the second half of Birth of a Nation.
Right.
The fear of the rioting blacks. I called it a Glenn Beck fever dream.
Yeah, the Tea Party probably wouldn't disagree with what's in most of this movie, certainly the second half. But controversial or not, what's great about the movie is what it's meant to the industry. You could call it the birth of a medium. Griffith was a pioneer in cross-cutting, flashbacks, Irish shots, and split screens too. Even the exorbitant length was new to movies. The film is more than 3 hours long, which was very unusual in the era of quickie two-reelers, and it made for a long day when we watched it a few days ago. It didn't happen overnight, but it jazz-singered the film business and made everyone see what could be done. You know, Griffith was 40 when it was made, and you had some thoughts about the context, Bev, about the context of when the movie was made and where he was and where America was.
Yeah, something that is unique about this movie, not 100% unique about this movie on the list, but something that isn't reflected in very many movies on the list is that it's almost 100 years old, which means there's nobody living who could have seen this movie in the proper historical context. It is now kind of in the realm, the same realm as old classic literature. Nobody alive really understands it the way it would have been understood when it first came out and probably the way it was intended. And something else that's worth thinking about when you're watching the movie is that when it came out, it was only 50 years after the Civil War. And, I mean, if you think about it this way, it's been about 40 years since the Vietnam War.
Yeah, pretty much.
So it'd be a similar context. Certainly, you know, Griffith was 40. His parents certainly lived through the Civil War and Reconstruction. He would have grown up hearing all kinds of firsthand accounts from his mom and dad, and his grandparents might have been veterans, and his aunts and uncles. Everybody would have, it would have been a really big, big part of his life. And comparing it to Vietnam isn't even fair, because the Civil War was a far more defining moment in American history than Vietnam. And the fact that you think about this, that you can think about this when you're watching the film, it gives it really an extra depth. And because it was so well done and so engaging, I really did catch myself thinking about the Civil War in a way, and reflecting on the Civil War, that I don't think other movies like this have ever really done to me.
Other movies have dealt with the topic, of course, and we'll get into those a little later on, the influence that the movie itself has, and just movies in general have dealt with this topic many times. But what Griffith did, of course, was to make a movie that was an event film as well, an event film bigger than maybe even modern event films, because they charged $2 for a ticket, which in 1915 is the equivalent of $46 now. That's like buying 2 boxes of popcorn. But that's huge. I mean, obviously, that makes it, like you said to me a few days ago, that's like a night out. That's an entire experience out. And of course, when the movie's 3 hours, maybe that's how he justified it. And there was an intermission, of course, back in those days, too. So you're probably at the theater for close to 4 hours, as opposed to those two-wheelers I talked about. But anyway, having said all of that, is it possible that the second half flaws are why it didn't make the 2007 list? Because it didn't. It was 44th, then it was, at best, 101st. That's a big drop. That's the second biggest drop of any film from the first list to the second. Dr. Zhivago was the worst at 39th, too, not making it at all. Now, of course, Intolerance replaced it. We'll talk about that one in the next podcast. But I would say there's not much doubt that people would have cast their vote for Birth of a Nation the first time because of the kinds of camera and editing techniques that it ushered in. But do you think it was voted off the island, so to speak, simply because of the racism?
It's the only explanation. I'm guessing that the American Film Institute got all kinds of backlash for putting that film in the list in the first place because it's so grotesquely racist. And let's say, this is not just regular... Yeah, I was prepared for some kind of Song of the South, colloquial racism, like blackface, and the type of thing that you expect that probably would have been common in 1915. No, this is some next level, really, really atrocious, heinous stuff. So yeah, it's quite possible that the critics got enough flack for putting it on the list that they avoided it. They replaced it with Intolerance,
which is apparently Griffith's apology for the previous movie. There are two things in particular, I think, that people would object to in Birth of a Nation. There are probably many things they could object to, but two in particular. One would be the scene where the sister character is Cameron character. She jumps off a cliff to avoid a black man, this slobbering black man from raping her, is what essentially is about to happen, apparently. And at the end, the siege, when the KKK come in riding in, and this victorious group, this band that come in to save the day when a woman's about to be... married off as well. And it's like the idea being, if you give blacks the right and the freedom just to live normal lives and not be slaves, they'll destroy every white thing that there is. And those two things are probably the single biggest problems with the movie that has a lot of issues. One of the things we didn't talk about yet, though, is that the black characters are played by white actors in blackface and pretty terrible looking makeup. Blackface, as jazz singer makeup, is even worse, but that's, he's a vaudeville performer. I mean, maybe you can excuse that a little bit more. Even a black woman maid character is played by a white man. Now, I wonder how the actress felt about being in such fake-looking blackface. Were they horrified? Were they okay with it? Or did they just want a job in Hollywood?
At the time, it was a big part of vaudeville. I don't imagine that it was strange at all. Even as late as the 50s, Orson Welles did blackface. He did Othello in blackface. Right. I don't think it was unusual. I doubt the actress had a problem with it.
Well, and I don't want to start accusing people when we don't know this to be true and when they're just simply cogs in Griffith's machine, but maybe they also agreed with what they were doing anyway. Maybe they had no problem with it whatsoever. Lillian Gish, the star of the movie, who was a big actress, a big star for many years, said in her autobiography, she said for many years she had great love for Griffith all the way through, and she said that she didn't think it was offensive. She didn't intend for it to be. She thought Griffith had nothing but noble intentions. She defended him to the end. So there you go. Here is a big star and somebody who must have been enlightened in some way, who clearly wasn't very enlightened.
It goes a long way to show you just how dense the cognitive dissonance was. Because Griffith himself was surprised at the backlash. He was surprised at how offended people got by that movie. But I think that just goes to show how indoctrinated the South was. Just how racist the South was. It's impossible to exaggerate how racist this movie is. One of the last shots of the movie is that Heaven and Hell set piece. And Hell is all, they're all black and writhing. And Heaven, it's all white people. And it's heavenly. And it's insane. It's so ignorant. It's really heinous.
It's almost like he was doing a parody, but of course he wasn't. It was very serious. And I've read many pieces of information that it was definitely an intentional movie. There's no way in the world that he's mocking people that actually feel this way. He clearly must have felt this way. But yeah, one of the things about the movie when it comes to an actual movie, though, rather regardless of the politics, is that the first half acting for a silent film, which a lot of the time silent film acting is pretty histrionic, and it's like, histrionics are us. Do you see me in the back row kind of thing. But for the most part, it's fairly realistic. But in this movie, in the second half, that's when, and primarily it's the black actors, or the white actors playing black actors, black characters, that's when it gets to be a little absurd.
The white women are really bad, too. There's Lillian Gish is, like, she literally flails her arms around to express her distress. And I think I said even when we were watching the movie that the pet little sister, as they call her, she's acting like literally a puppy. Like she jumps around, she smothers people with kisses on their face. She's so childish and really, really puppy-like. And it's pretty unrealistic. I found there was the acting got pretty hammy as it went on. Something I want to add about the racist aspect is it was interesting to, like, you really don't often see a movie that so earnestly presenting an unpopular point of view. And when you're watching something like that and it's employing all of the language of cinema to convince its audience of its opinion, and when you're watching something that is so, I just want to say wrong, it's so counter what we believe and the values that we hold, you notice the mechanisms. Like, you, when you're watching something like that, you can't help but see the strings because you're so horrified by the message, where when a movie is just encouraging something that you already believe and values that you already hold, I think you just feel it. You don't see it. But you see the mechanisms in this movie. You see the hero shots of the little colonel on his horse in his KKK uniform coming to the rescue, and he looks like a white knight. And you see that shot, and you just see the strings. You see the language that Griffith is using. And that was kind of, I guess, like a academically fun thing about watching this movie.
Right. Well, the original title of the movie, by the way, is The Klansman. Yeah. And that seems like a smart change. But the movie was still banned in major markets like L.A. and Chicago. And then his response to that was, well, I'll make Intolerance then, and that'll be our next podcast. All right, let's get into one more aspect before we close out here. And that's to me, the most important reason to do these things is the influence on other movies, in particular, I guess, the influence on movies that made the AFI list. So 143 years after the South lost the Civil War and the slaves were freed, a black man would be elected president, believe that or not. And just like 142 years after the Civil War ended, a black man would have one of his movies make the AFI list, and that was Spike Lee for Do the Right Thing. And for that matter, M. Night Shyamalan with The Sixth Sense is an Indian American, so two non-whites. Because the original list, 100 films, every single one of those was directed by a white man.
So it took longer for a minority director to make the list than it took for a minority to become president of the United States.
Almost, no, because the list, 2007, the second list came out. And
the election.
But it was close. It was very close.
It was a squeaker.
It was about a year difference.
Hollywood beat politics, beat Washington.
But just barely.
By just like a year. A year. Congratulations, Hollywood. It's post-racial America. Still no women. Still no women on the list.
No women directors just yet, but there may be one of these days. If next time they do a list like this, Catherine Bigelow might have a shot at it, or even Sofia Coppola. But a little bit more about the influence of A Birth of a Nation on other movies. Now, for all we've criticized about it, there are other movies that won Academy Awards. The Oscars didn't exist in 1915. They were still 12 years away. But Crash, Driving Miss Daisy, and Heat of the Night, they all won the Oscar for Best Picture, and they're kind of clumsy, sort of unsubtle, in-your-face, racist issues as well. But in smarter ways, I guess you could say the To Kill a Mockingbird, which I have not seen since 1998 when the list first was released. I want to see it again. We will, of course, eventually see it again. But there's the attempted rape in that movie, or the accused rape, maybe is a better way of putting it, that the character goes through that Gregory Peck is defending. And this movie, of course, it's a set piece where the woman jumps off a cliff to avoid the same basic thing. I don't know if there was a deliberate influence, but it's an interesting parallel.
It's like the polar opposite of the rape in Birth of a Nation.
Right, right.
Because in To Kill a Mockingbird, the villain is the woman. She is lying about the rape.
Yes, that's right. It's in the whole thing in To Kill a Mockingbird is, I couldn't do it, or whatever the line is. His hands are messed up. And yet it doesn't matter that the jury still convicts him and he goes to jail. I guess the other influence that I thought was kind of interesting, we were watching, I took a note that said the Star Wars storyline could be loosely based on Birth of a Nation, because you get your band of revolutionaries who don't like the way their bad guy leaders are running things, so they revolt and try to take back power. And yeah, I'm the rare guy, perhaps not the only guy, but the rare guy to compare the Jedi to the KKK.
Yes, the South Carolina Congress was the Death Star.
I guess so. But I guess we should wrap it up. A few more things I want to say. I liked elements, again, this is a technical thing, but I liked how it didn't overuse the title cards. So many silent movies will have characters say whatever they're saying. Unless you read lips, you don't know what they're saying. And then it cuts to a title card and it said, yes! And, you know, we get it. You don't necessarily need to write that at all. And Birth of a Nation smartly doesn't overdo that. What they do is they have title cards that set the scene for us, or the George Lucas thing of explaining the political situation in long dialogue. But fair enough, it works well, and other silent films should have taken that hint of not having every little piece of dialogue that isn't relevant anyway be said to us.
He leans heavily on visual storytelling, which is what he should do, probably part of why the movie is as effective as it is.
Especially for a silent movie. We mentioned Lincoln earlier, by the way, the movie Lincoln that is still in theaters right now, a big hit. And there are some parallels in those two movies. I don't know if Spielberg was really necessarily influenced by Birth of a Nation in particular, but he's got the brutal hand-to-hand combat right at the very beginning of Lincoln, where a person is drowned under somebody's boot by a black man drowning a white man in that scene. And you've got the similar thing with Birth of a Nation. You've got these brutal hand-to-hand combat scenes, and it's like a birth of a war scene in the movie. And, of course, Spielberg's become known as the guy who can direct such great war scenes. We didn't really talk too much with the actors in this, which isn't really relevant, I don't think, to get right into every single character. But I guess the major character of the whole thing would be Thaddeus Stevens' stand-in, who's called Stoneman in this movie. Thaddeus Stevens, I didn't know much about him until I saw Lincoln. That's who Tommy Lee Jones plays. And he's the abolitionist who strongly believes in ending racism. Not that a lot of other people didn't, too, but he was somebody who had a lot of power, who was not just in favor of it, but was strongly in favor of it. And that character is complicated in his way, because he, at the end of the movie, of course, he's fine with the mulatto character marrying a white woman until he finds out, not my daughter. Nevertheless, he's a big part of this movie. And
that's when he changes his entire tune. When he discovers, like, the whole time he's pro-abolition, he ignores all of the horrible things that are happening in the town, which is that black marauders are, you know, burning down homes and just tearing the place apart, taking over, ruining Congress. He's ignoring all of this. He's blind to all that until the moment when Silas Lynch says he has intentions on his daughter. And then he just immediately discovers the errors of his ways. Something that's almost comical about the racism in this movie is how it is all universally comes back to this fear that all these black men are going to rape their white women.
Yes.
They're going to want to rape the white women.
It's inevitable.
Yes, obviously. They are animals. There's a scene at the end of the movie when Papa Cameron, can't remember his name, is stuck in a cabin with one of his daughters, the still living daughter, and some other people, and it's the cabin is surrounded by black marauders, and it looks like they're gonna lose, and it looks, you know, it's looking dark, and he's in there waiting for all these men to come in, and you know, whatever will happen, presumably they'll be killed in retaliation for the fact that he was a slave owner, by the way. They, you know, they never really address the fact that the whole Cameron family got wealthy and had everything that they had because they owned slaves. But that's neither here nor there. So while he's expecting the worst. He has his daughter by the hair and his arm lifted up with a rifle in his hand, as though very clearly he has the intention, as soon as they break down that door, he's going to murder his daughter rather than let her fall in the hands of those darkies.
Like in The Road, I guess you could say, the Viggo Mortensen movie, where it's maybe more understandable, too, that, you know, he gives his gun to the son, kind of, I think it's about the middle of the road. Interesting phrase. And he basically says, if they, you know, these cannibals get in here and want to take you apart, you should kill yourself. More understandable, because in that sequence, we find there are people in the basement who are being kept to be eaten slowly but surely. So it's more understandable.
But so being raped by a black man would be as bad as being slowly eaten by cannibals.
In the eyes of D.W. Griffith, that's probably true.
And being raped by a black man is a complete inevitability of a black man getting their hands on you.
That is what's going to happen. That's not a possibility. It's what's going to happen.
It's so bad.
I think we should,
so
you know what we should do? They should remake this movie and let Spike Lee have a shot at it.
I would totally watch that. I'd wait in line. I'd pay $2 to see that movie.
You'd pay $2. Would you pay the current prices of whatever they are, $13.95 or whatever the hell it costs these days? All right, so we got to say one more thing before we end this. It's a random thought, but it's one thing we talked about when it was over. We love the irony of watching one of the first, you know, modern movies, one of the first, not modern, I guess now, but one of the first big-name movies on a computer. And, of course, it's a movie that is so old and tattered-looking, and that's how far we've come technologically, I guess. And that's what this movie essentially is all about when it comes to its place in history, is the technological innovations. If it weren't for those, we wouldn't be talking about it at all, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
So, whether or not it's a worthy inclusion on this list is debatable. I would say it probably is. But, of course, in 2007, it was not. And what replaced it, essentially, not literally, but what replaced it essentially was Griffith's follow-up, Intolerance. And that's going to be next week. So tune in.
Apology tour, 1915 style.
1916 by that
1916
point.
Style.
So tune in.
Yes. And if you'd like to reach Ryan and I, you can go to our webpage, top100project.wordpress.com. Leave a comment. We'd love to hear what you think. You can also reach us at top100projectpodcast@gmail.com and follow Ryan on Twitter @moviefiend51. And